Topic of our Dhamma talk tonight is the insight knowledge of the fast arising passing way of formations known in the Pali scriptural language as Udaya Bhaya Jnana. And so this is one of the insight knowledges that occurs on the path, and quite a number of you have already experienced it and are even beyond it, and thus it's appropriate to explain what it's all about, both from a theoretical as well as a practical point of view. And for those who have not experienced it yet, well, at least it gives them some idea of what might happen next in the practice. To start with Dhammapada verse 113, that's deals with this particular knowledge. Yocha vasasartam jiva apasam udayabhyam ekam jivitam seyo pasato udayabhyam. The English translation of this is better than 100 years in the life of a person who does not perceive the arising and the dissolution of formations or of the five aggregates is a day. Just a single day in the life of one who perceives the arising and dissolution of the five aggregates. Now, this Satna Dhammapada verse, and there are actually a number of others that can be found in the Dhammapada that all speak towards this particular insight knowledge, and they all mark or highlight the importance of gaining this knowledge at least for a day in one's life. Now, this insight, knowledge, as you have heard in the meantime, consists of two parts, namely a tender phase and then a mature phase. And the tender phase of it covers what? Who knows? Yes, indeed, the imperfections of insight, and there are 10 in number. And so this fourth insight knowledge consists of those 10 imperfections, and then once a meditator goes beyond the imperfections and is no longer under the sway of them, in such a person does the mature phase of Udiyabhya Jnana arise. And from a classificatory point of view, when we look at this particular insight knowledge and then compare it with the so-called seven purifications, and then we find that the tender phase of this fourth insight knowledge is governed by the purification of knowledge and vision of what is the path and not path. So that's one purification. The next one is the purification of the knowledge and vision of the path. And actually, the next one, the second phase, the mature phase of the fourth insight knowledge, then marks the beginning of that purification of knowledge and vision of the path. And it is followed by a number of other insight knowledges, which all the way up to the knowledge anuloma jnana, of conformity, that then come under it. Now, during that tender phase of the knowledge of the fast arising, passing away of formations, it is said that a meditator is experiencing anicca, dukkha and anatta to some extent. And then the Suddhimagga, on the path of purification, raises the question, why then does a meditator have to experience the three universal characteristics, or why does a meditator have to pursue the knowledge of rise and fall again? And so the answer is given as follows, namely in chapter 21, paragraph 2 of the Visuddhimagga, namely to observe the three characteristics. And so the characteristics of anicca, dukkha and anatta, and the knowledge of rise and fall that occurred early on, and that was very much governed by the imperfection, so the tender knowledge of the arising passing of formations, was as yet not capable of observing those three characteristics in their true nature. And because it was still overwhelmed or influenced by the 10 imperfections. And so in the presence of the 10 imperfections, the three universal characteristics kind of lose their influence, or their predominance, this might be a better word. And so they don't quite stick out, they're not all that predominant. And so the answer then to the question raised is to clearly see the three characteristics, but without the influence of of the 10 imperfections of insight. Now, from an etymological point of view, the Pali term udaya beya jnana is a compound term, and so it consists of three parts, or actually more than this. Jnana is knowledge, and then udaya is one part, and beya is another part. And that first part, udaya, we can then break up even further into ud, which means out in an upward direction, out of, like it is used in the word, in the Pali verb umujati, which means to rise up out of water or something else. And then the second part to the first compound, eya, is a form, or stems from the verb e, which means to go. And so to rise up out of, or in an upward direction, and so to rise or to go upward. And then as for the second part, beya, so this consists of the prefix beya, which means, and be stands for asunder, denoting disturbance, separation or destruction, and or sometimes simply down. And so then part ayat again has the same meaning as mentioned earlier on, so it's a form of to go. So to go down, or to go asunder. Hence this Pali expression udaya beya has been translated as increase and decrease, or as rise and fall, or as birth and death, as up and down, or simply as arising and passing away. So udaya beya jnana is your knowledge of the arising and passing away. And since These formations tend to, at the peak of the knowledge, tend to arise in a quick manner, arise and pass away in a quick manner, hence that adjective is being added. Now, the mature phase has some very distinct features to it. Namely, when it comes to the arising of an object, no matter what the physical or mental object may be, this object is not in any way getting ready to arise. It's not kind of gathering a momentum to then pop up. And it's also not waiting there to get or to arise. Likewise, once an object has disappeared, it does not go to another place or gather there. But rather, what happens is that an object suddenly arises and suddenly it disappears. And so basically it is one new object after another that is arising and passing away. Now, in the Burmese language, this particular feature of this knowledge of Uddiyabhya and Jnana is given as ku pye and ku pye. And so ku stands for aku, which means now, and pye means to be or to become, and pye means to destroy or to get destroyed. So now arising, now getting destroyed or disappearing. Now, a further really important feature of this knowledge is that a meditator usually or typically experiences among the three parts, namely beginning, middle and end, a meditator experiences only two parts. And those are the beginning of the object, the arising of it, and then the ending of it, the dissolution of it. Now, the Patisamvida Magga, the path of discrimination, has defined this knowledge in a very succinct manner. Namely, the wisdom in contemplating the change in the change of present phenomena. So, the wisdom in contemplating the change of present phenomena. Now, the attention needs to be drawn to the expression change of present phenomena. And what happens at this point in our meditation practice is that a meditator is no longer occupied with the objects of the past nor with objects of the future. Remember, in the third insight knowledge, by inferential knowledge from what was what was happening in the present moment, a meditator then deducted inferentially that what is valid or what happens in the present moment also happened in the past and will also happen in the future. Now, here, in this fourth insight knowledge, there's none of that. No, there's no coming to any conclusion by inferential knowledge. But rather, the meditator's attention is fully focused on the present moment. Now, in order to see impermanence, a meditator needs to see, you know, the dissolution of an object. And so, you know, it needs to arise. So at this particular point in the practice, both of these aspects are present, namely the arising of it and the dissolution of it. Now, you might remember from, you know, one of the earlier Dhamma talks on anicca, that on impermanence, that a meditator sees this impermanence in different ways. So at first, in the third insight knowledge, a meditator will see an object arising, lasting for a while, maybe also changing, and then eventually disappearing. And this process could last anything from maybe at least 30 seconds or a minute to several minutes. So a meditator would see a pain arising and then undergoing a number of transformations, and then only after maybe several minutes or so would that same pain disappear. Now, in the fourth insight knowledge, things become much more dynamic. And barely has an object arisen, does it disappear already, or does it disappear? And the middle portion of it, the occurrence of the lasting aspect of it, is rather short and, from a meditator's point of view, negligible, not that discernible. Now, since objects are occurring at a rather quick speed, coming and going, this requires that our mindfulness is rather dull and slow, or rather quick and sharp. Quick and sharp, that's the obvious. And however, just think, if your mindfulness would possess the qualities it had in the third insight knowledge, and objects would arise in quick succession, as this commonly happens in the fourth insight knowledge, well, most likely, as a meditator, you wouldn't be able to keep up with the flow of events. And so, what I'm trying to say is that the meditation practice unfolds in such a way that the observing mind and the necessary accompanying mental states are always up to the mark, and up to the mark to keep up with what is happening in the practice. To give you another example, at an earlier point, let's say during the first and second insight knowledge, the mind is, or objects are, still very coarse. And so is the observing and knowing mind. However, when our practice gradually moves into the third insight knowledge, and in particular the part about anatta, the absence of a self, where the objects tend to become rather refined, well, by then the mind is already in a better shape, and it's gradually developing towards increasing refinement. And so all these necessary changes of mindfulness and the other relevant mental factors are gradually taking place at just at the right time. Now, when a meditator seas of formations are in a very direct manner and clear-cut manner, sees how formations keep coming and going, appearing and disappearing, then this certainly is rather inspiring. The meditator feels encouraged by this and certainly will then want to proceed with his or her meditation practice with greater determination. And will want to take the practice all the way to its very end, to its goal. Now, as explained earlier on, during the tenure phase of the fourth insight knowledge of the fast arising passing away formations, the three characteristics weren't all that clear, because they were under the influence, or meditator was under the influence of the ten imperfections of insight. Now, during this mature phase, things change, and a meditator then will clearly, or will understand the thing that is impermanent, plus the characteristic of impermanence, the thing that is suffering or unsatisfactory, and the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness, and then the thing that is certainly lacking itself, and the characteristic of non-self. So the objects, or the things that are impermanent, unsatisfactory, lacking itself, are of course certainly the objects of the five aggregates, and the characteristic of impermanence is that of arising and passing and passing away, and the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness is that of oppression through rise and fall, and the characteristic of non-self is the insusceptibility to the exercise of power. So we can, objects are not happening according to our wishes, our will, but rather according to conditions. Now, when a meditator experiences this insight of the fast arising passing away of formations, and then he is well advised to stay with it for some time, and to see this arising and passing away of formations with regard to as many objects as possible. So not just the rise and fall of the abdomen, but also with regard to various kinds of sensations in the body, pains and aches, and also with regard to the mental factors, and then with regard to the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching process, and thinking process, and also in the walking meditation. And so at first, this may seem like an unnecessary exercise. However, this will prepare the mind for what will happen next. And so It is in connection with this Dhamma delight, and also seeing the arising and passing of formations, that the Buddha has spoken the following verse, as is recorded in Dhammapada verse 373. The bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, male or female meditator who goes into seclusion to meditate, whose mind is tranquil, who clearly perceives the Dhamma, experiences a joy which transcends that of ordinary men and women. Now, when one undertakes this Vipassana practice, one then will also sooner or later understand, and as we've discussed already earlier on when talking about the three universal characteristics, the thing that covers up impermanence is continuity, and the thing that covers up unsatisfactoriness is lies in the change of postures, and then what covers up the characteristic of non-self is certain compactness. And so it is the continuity, and but also the compactness that plus even the unsatisfactory part that play a vital role during this insight knowledge. Namely, earlier on, a meditator saw formations, formations like the rise and fall of the abdomen, as one continuous movement. Or a meditator back then saw the pain as one solid, compact object. Now, this then changes if one does not change one's certain posture. And with the deepening of one's mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, a meditator gradually sees how the rising and falling movement of the abdomen actually consists of a number, if not many, tiny such arising movements, and one after another. And the pain that seemed all that solid then breaks up, or may be witnessed as breaking up into many parts or particles. And so, when a meditator keeps observing or investigating into what actually is occurring in the body and in the mind, and observing various kinds of bodily sensations and various kinds of mental states, well, then it becomes pretty obvious that there is no self. And so all we have are some basic ultimate categories which occur in different certain compositions. Now, when one observes very carefully, one might find that even the observing mind itself, so the mindfulness, is not continuous, but rather it consists of a series of moments of mindfulness, one after another. So one moment of mindfulness will then see or observe one segment of a rising movement, then the next moment of mindfulness will see the next segment of the rising movement of the abdomen, and so on and so forth. And so the arising of one segment goes together, coincides with the arising of that one moment of mindfulness. And the dissolution of both of them, namely the segment of the rising and the corresponding mindfulness, then also happens simultaneously. So what this is pointing at is another particular feature of this fourth insight knowledge, namely that the mind and the object observed work together really, really well. And so there is no lagging behind of the mindfulness. And so as soon as an object arises, the observing and knowing mind is right there. And so, this is very different from what we experience as meditators in the earlier insight knowledges. So earlier on, it's a common familiar experience that an object arises, and then only after quite some time, and only after the thinking subsides to some extent or degree, that the mindfulness then actually turns towards the object. And also back then, it's not uncommon for a meditator's mind, observing and knowing mind, to slip off the object. So not to get it right, not to penetrate into the center of it. Now, here during the fourth insight knowledge, the mindfulness is rather well developed. It's certain quick, it's sharp, and very dynamic and on target, if you like to. Now, earlier on, it was mentioned that there are, to any object, whatever the object may be, three parts, namely its beginning, its middle, and its end, or we can say its birth, its decay, and its death. The Pali scriptural terms for these three are upada, ditti, and bhanga. And so out of these three parts in the fourth insight knowledge, the beginning, upada, and the ending or the dissolution of an object, bhanga, are predominant, are obvious. Whereas the middle portion, ditti, isn't all that clear. It's not that it's not there, but it's just extremely short. And so maybe to add at this point that in terms of the duration of the arising passing of one object, well, it's something in the range of just a few moments or a few seconds, and not more than that. And when listening to or meditators' certain reports, then one has to ask how long one object would typically last. Is this rather a matter of several minutes, or a matter of just a few moments or a few seconds? So if it's just a few seconds, then it's quite likely that it's an experience that fits into the fourth insight knowledge. Sometimes meditators they think they're experiencing the arising of an object, and then it lasts for a minute or two, and then it disappears, and then they think, oh, this is already the peak of the fourth insight knowledge, when of course it's not not up to that level yet. Now, the fourth insight knowledge of the fascinating passing away of formations marks kind of a major this point in or face in our insight meditation. And so it is the knowledge that, as mentioned before, is rather rewarding and also rather inspiring. And subjectively, meditators feel quite satisfied with it. They're quite satisfied with their own meditation, and what contributes to this is the clarity of the experiences. The observing mind itself tends to be rather clear. And the objects observed too tend to be clear, if not certainly crystal clear. So no wonder that the meditators consider this as certainly good meditation practice. And and it's very different, as we've seen already, from experiences during the earlier insight knowledges, which were, as you will recall, oftentimes quite labored, difficult, and certainly full of troubles. Now, when one experiences this insight knowledge, one feels encouraged to go on with the practice. And so indeed, this then provides the momentum to pursue the meditation further. Now, during a retreat, it's really good and if the retreat isn't too short, and so instead it's somewhat longer than 10 days, because this simply gives meditators a chance to get at least to this fourth insight knowledge, if not even further. And so, and then when the retreat comes to an end, then meditators feel quite satisfied with their retreat, and they can leave the retreat with a positive note. Otherwise, if as mentioned during one of the earlier Dhamma talks, if one ends in dukkha, one in dukkha jnana, then one might not feel carrying on. Now, in the context of this fourth insight knowledge, but also later on in the practice, it's helpful to know about the fourfold compactness. The Pali technical term for this is ghana, and the word is spelled G-H-A-N-A, and it consists of four kinds, namely compact as a continuity, santatikana, then compactness as a mass, samuhagana, then compactness as a function, kichagana, and compactness as an object, aramnagana. So, and at first, objects seem to be compact in these four different ways, and objects or the practice in general. However, this then changes. Now, compactness as a continuity we've discussed already. While observing objects, gradually we find that they're breaking up into parts, into particles, into segments, and so on. And so that then dissolves or dispels this wrongful perception as compactness as a continuity. Now, as for the second one, compactness as a mass, samuha nagana. Now, sometimes we'll experience an object like a paint. There's maybe a mass of hardness, and so And it seems rather solid, rather than compact. And so then when we go deeper into it, you know, we see how this mass of hardness, you know, and then gradually breaks up. And then when it comes to the third, compactness as a function, this is somewhat more difficult to explain and to understand. As a meditator goes through the different insight knowledges, he or she will sooner or later understand that each and every insight knowledge performs a certain function. And so for instance, the function of impermanence is to dispel or abandon the wrongful perception of as permanence, as permanent. And so, the function of dukkha is to dispel the wrongful perception as leading to or conducive to pleasure or happiness. And so, as one's practice later on might be moving up and down a little bit, so the so-called yo-yo effect might take place. For a while one develops one's practice, it progresses, it ascends, and then maybe owing to a lapse in one's mindfulness, one's practice drops off. And this drop sometimes may involve several insight knowledges. So if this happens several times in a row, gradually a meditator becomes familiar with the different insight knowledges, and then will also understand, this particular knowledge that I'm in right now usually performs such and such a function. And then as the practice moves on, the meditator kind of assumes or can predict that the next insight knowledge will occur in a certain way. So the practice becomes somewhat predictable owing to more experience. And then comes the big surprise. And it comes with the so-called, destruction of this compactness as a function. And the way I like to compare this is to the so-called chaos button in computers. Now, not every computer will have a chaos button, but as I've read in some newspaper article, like these highly sophisticated computers used on spy planes have such a function. Namely, for the case that the spy plane gets shot down or is forced to land somewhere in an enemy country. And so as a way of preventing that, all the highly sensitive information that has been gathered over longer periods, so to prevent that this information gets into the hands of the enemy, well, these certain computers have a so-called chaos button. And what the chaos button does is when one presses it, it deletes all the information on the computer. And so, when a meditator experiences one of the somewhat higher insight knowledges, there is a phase where everything, all objects rising and falling and so on and so forth, seem as manifest in a rather chaotic manner. And to exemplify this, so you'll be looking at the rising and falling, and then let's say one rising, and at first it takes a quick start, and then it slows down, and then it's hard, and then next moment it's soft, and then it's tight, and then it's relaxed, and then some warmth is there, and then some cold is there. So it's all over the place. And so the meditator usually loses the bearings at this point, because nothing fits the ordinary the ordinary experience anymore, or the ordinary patterns anymore. And so it is at this point in the practice that this compactness as a function breaks up and is no longer valid. So, to some extent, the practice is predictable, but then at certain points, again, it's unpredictable. Now, compactness as an object means, aramnagana in the Pali language, means that at first an object like a pane may seem rather solid, rather compact. However, upon a closer observation, frequent observation, this pain would be seen as breaking up into, or maybe spreading out over a larger area, and moving here, moving there, and then an area of pain may be seen as consisting of many tiny little pain points, and these then might be seen as coming and going. So when that happens, the compactness as an object is certainly no longer valid. And so, as part of this process of the dissolution of, or breaking up of, the compactness in various senses, there is another compactness that suddenly breaks up. And the question to you, what might this be? And some of you have already experienced and reported it.
Body.
In the body, yes, and in which sense?
It's just parts, and rather than being one solid item.
Yes.
It's just pieces of observation, really.
Yes, and Alan, what about the so-called boundary or contour of the body? Is that still clearly seen or not? No more. Is absolutely correct. Excellent. Indeed, what we have at this point is that a certain process comes to its certain peak, namely the process, the transition from conventional or conceptual reality to ultimate reality. And it is a process that is well known and well described in the meditation practice. Now, the Venerable Mahasisada of Burma says in this connection, when the concept is seen, the ultimate reality is not seen. When the ultimate reality is seen, the concept is no longer seen. Now, to give you one very simplistic example to start with. Namely, at the very, very outset of our meditation practice, so please think back to day one. You've just arrived and you're settling in, and you've heard the instructions, observe rising and falling, and then you try your best, and then as the rising or as the abdomen expands, well, you think of a flower. A flower blossoming. And then as the abdomen contracts, you think of that same flower as contracting. So, blossoming, contracting. And so you're totally hooked to this picture or concept of the flower blossoming and contracting. Or if you don't like this example, then I can also choose another one, namely that of a balloon. A balloon, so the rising movement of the abdomen is Oftentimes described as it is like a balloon that is inflating, and the falling movement is like a balloon that is deflating. And so a meditator, very oftentimes a beginning meditator is fascinated with this concept, and it seems to describe so nicely what is going on that the meditator is not going any deeper than this, and is not really knowing the predominant sensations that are occurring in the rising movement and in the falling movement. So sensations like, as you all know by now, tension, stiffness, tightness in the rising, and maybe a sense of relaxation, contraction, and a number of other sensations in the falling movement. So there's in this context there is another development, namely the shape or form of an object, and this includes the boundary or contour of the body. This is said to be just a concept. The mind is greatly making use of concepts, apparently in order to simplify the mental operations. And so when we at first sit in meditation with eyes closed, we will have a pretty definite sense of where our body ends and where the air around it starts. And so we think this is absolutely normal. That's the way it's supposed to be. And so then As we continue with our meditation practice, we sooner or later realize that at times that shape or form of the body is somewhat out of whack. And sometimes, some meditators are reporting this rather in a vivid manner. Even though both hands are placed on the lap, it seems as if one arm is totally deformed, maybe something like this, and pointing into a different direction. However, the meditator knows that he and she didn't place the arm in that certain way. And so something is funny here. And a greenhorn meditator, so to speak, might even get a little bit scared. What is going to happen with me? Am I going to end up deformed when I leave this retreat? And not just deformation of the arms. In a worst case, sometimes meditators say, they sit in meditation and they observe really well and in a concentrated manner, and then it seems as if one leg is cut off. So really as if with an axe cut off. So only a stump of it is left. So if you have this kind of an impression, then good luck. And so at least 4 or 5 minutes or 10 minutes will you be wondering what is going on here in my practice. And so it's for these kind of cases that a meditation teacher needs to explain what is happening. So these so-called deformations, or even losing parts of one's body, limbs of the body, seemingly is part of the process of the transition from conceptual reality to ultimate reality. And when a meditator is approaching the fifth insight knowledge, which is the knowledge of dissolution, and which is the knowledge that follows the knowledge of the, you know, the fast arising, passing away of formations, then concept of a shape or form of the body is certainly pretty much gone. And so there may be, the last point where breaks up all together. So before it's just a prelude over several insight knowledges, sometimes already starting with the first insight knowledge and then reaching its maximum in the fifth insight knowledge. And so usually in the fifth insight knowledge, meditators no longer find a boundary, a clear-cut boundary or shape or form into the body. And an amazing thing happens. A meditator will say, I can bet on it, and that's or testify to it, that a pain is somewhere, the pain is clearly experienced, but the meditator no longer is in a position to say whether it's in the right leg or left leg or maybe even in the torso. So the ability to locate a sensation falls away. And so it is at this point that a meditator needs to be instructed to simply just go for the bare sensation, even if one can no longer locate it locate it. And so in this case, if a pain is there, then just focus on the pain itself and don't worry trying to find out where the pain is located at. Now that, to many meditators, is quite a dramatic shift in events. And actually from this point onwards, for the most part, the shape or form of the body is then no longer clear. So the concept simply has fallen away. And to add this for further clarification, the pain itself or some other predominant sensation is considered to be ultimate reality, because this is what is truly existing. You're not imagining the pain that is there. No, you're not conjuring it up. But it arises, and so even it's there at the beginning of the practice, and it may be experienced during the middle phase of the practice, and a pain may then arise also towards the end of the practice. So that's a true reality. Now, this fourth insight knowledge, its tender phase as well as certain mature phase, has been described in different ways, with different certain illustrations, and one of them is to bring across the short-lived nature of objects. It's said the practice or objects are like dew drops at sunrise, so obviously they don't last too long. Or even better, more realistic, like bubbles on water. So maybe when it rains, a raindrop falls onto the surface of water, and raindrop then forms or causes a bubble, and that bubble then pops. Or another rather convincing example is when you draw with the help of a stick, when you draw a line on the surface of water, then what will happen? Yes, right, it suddenly disappears, it won't last. And the same thing goes when lightning strikes. This is a rather short-lived experience. And to bring across the idea that certain formations seem rather continuous or rather compact, another illustration is given, namely that of the wheel of whirling firebrand. So actually, when you in a circus or so, when you see such an event, then it seems like one round certain flame, but in actuality it's not that, but rather it consists of a wheel that has in some spots some flames, and the wheel turns certainly very quickly to then create the impression of a circle of fire, a continuous circle of fire. Now, another highly interesting and telling feature in the context of the fourth insight knowledge regarding objects is that of the location of an object and certainly the sequence of objects. So, are you experiencing an object that is arising and then moving around and in various ways and then disappearing in a different spot? This will be one option. Or are you experiencing an object that is occurring in one spot and it's disappearing in exactly the same spot? So, two options here. And then another criterion is namely the sequence of objects. Are you experiencing one object that is lasting for a while, and while you're observing it, another more predominant object occurs, and before the first object has disappeared, the attention moves on to the second object? And so, and then while you're observing the second object, and it's still going on, a third, more predominant object arises and calls your attention. So at that point, your objects are kind of overlapping. So this is one case. And the other case is the occurrence of objects in a linear fashion, one object after another. So an object arises, may last for a while, and so, or less, and so, then disappears. And only after it has disappeared does the next object occur. So in the case of the fourth insight knowledge, it's usually that objects arise in one spot and then do what? Who knows? Occur in one spot and do they move around and then disappear, or do they disappear in the same spot? In the same spot. They disappear in the same spot. Quite correct. And in terms of sequence, in the fourth insight knowledge, is the sequence rather a sequence of overlapping objects, or is it a linear sequence of objects, one after another? Who knows? The linear, yes, is right. And so those are two small criteria that oftentimes go unnoticed. But once you know them, it's really helpful to understand what is going on in one's own meditation practice. And with this, you have a tool to use in the future. Sorry. Now, the Venerable Mahasisada points out, and this is obvious, that it is during the fourth insight knowledge that the enlightenment factors come to predominance. And it's not that the enlightenment factors like mindfulness, investigation of states, and effort and joy, and then tranquility, and then concentration and equanimity, that these mental factors don't exist in the mind. This is not the case. They are latent in the stream of consciousness. However, at the very outset of our meditation practice, they are pretty weak, and so they need to be developed. And so during the fourth insight knowledge, in particular during the tender phase of the imperfections, the enlightenment factors become quite obvious to a meditator. And then from that point onwards, do they develop further? Sometimes, not being all that predominant, but later on during the higher insight knowledges, especially the knowledge of reobservation, and in particular the knowledge of equanimity about formations, will these enlightenment factors become very strong, and then also gradually well balanced. Now, it is certainly said that when a meditator reaches this point in his or her meditation practice, so the fourth insight knowledge, and then continues to practice under a skilled teacher, then he or she is almost assured to gain stream entry in this very life. So it's indeed a major phase in the meditation, and once one gets this far, one shouldn't just drop the meditation practice and turn one's back on it, but rather continue. And usually it is also at this point in the meditation that the so-called five limbs of striving, the Paddhanyanga, in the Pali scriptural language, consisting of faith, of good health, and sincerity, and energy, and wisdom, are present. Now, during this fourth insight knowledge, the mind overall tends to be, what do you think, more on the unwholesome side or more on the wholesome side? Wholesome, yes indeed. So plenty of wholesome mental states arise, and certain faith will be there, equanimity will be there, and certain some tranquility will be there, and concentration will be strong, and so on and so forth. Now, this then means that the mind is relatively purified of impurities. And the commentary says that owing to the purification of the mind arises a purification of the blood. So the blood then is going through the entire body, and the blood, the purified blood that then permeates the entire body and all the different body organs, will then provide those same organs with fresh and purified blood. And if a meditator, a person, happens to suffer from some illness, and it involves a certain bodily organ, then reaching this fourth insight knowledge may make a big difference. And so unhealthy, unhealthy tissue and blood and whatnot, then gets replaced by highly purified blood. And this is supposed to lead certainly to an improvement in one's health. Now, there have been plenty of such cases, and so such cases recorded in a booklet which the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw initiated called Dhamma Therapy. And so, this Dhamma therapy, or Dhamma cures, if you like, to occur at this point in the practice, but also during the, let's say, 10th or more so 11th insight knowledge, the knowledge of equanimity about certain formations. And what meditators do report quite frequently is an improvement of their senses, namely improvement of the eyesight, improvement of the hearing ability to hear, and so, or hearing sensitivity, and then smelling sensitivity, and tasting and touching sensitivity. So now, those are benefits, side benefits, benefits that come with the practice. Now, as with the imperfections of insight, but more so even during this mature phase of the knowledge of the fast arising and passing away formations, when a meditator sees how quick the mind can operate, and how positive and wholesome it can be, this then gives a meditator an idea of the potential of the mind, or the potential of developing the mind. So when one doesn't meditate, one doesn't really realize the potential of the mind, and one just accepts it as it is, as dull and sluggish and unruly as it usually tends to be, and we just sort of think that's normal, and why do something about it? But as a meditator, we start seeing the mind from a different perspective. So we learn as we go along, and this kind of opens up new avenues. And one should, by all means, pursue those pursue that further development of the mind. Now, there are two insight knowledges that are somewhat similar in nature, and those two are the fourth insight knowledge, so the knowledge of the fast arising passing away of formations, and which other one?
The eleventh,
yes, is correct, the knowledge of equanimity about formations. And however, they are not exactly the same. And so, which one do you think is better? Well, the second one. And then, Nicola, what do you think? Which one is more refined? The fourth one or the 11th one?
I'm guessing the 11th.
Oh, you're just guessing. You must be more than guessing. And now, there is a short passage somewhere in the text which speaks of stagnation. It's actually a Vipassana riddle, the stagnation within, and stagnation within. And this happens when a meditator experiences these imperfections of insight. At first, we've seen by now, they seem rather appealing, attractive. However, if one gets caught up in them, then the practice will stagnate. And it is at this point that a meditator is encouraged to use what is known as strong mindfulness or strong vipassana, balawa vipassana. And all of this is said in the context of the five ways of nourishing nourishment of the practice. So when one experiences those imperfections, one should not get caught up in them, but rather boost one's effort and boost one's mindfulness and go beyond them. Now, when it comes to the experience of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen or any other predominant object, there are different levels of experience to it. So, as mentioned earlier on, at the very beginning of our meditation, we can see the rising and falling in a very conceptual manner, namely as that famous balloon being inflated or inflating and deflating. And then later on we may discover some of its specific sensations, and then later on we may see it as arising and lasting for a while and then passing away, and again different sensations are involved in this. And then as we are going along, we may also see the rising and falling movement in a segmented way, so it's not just one continuous movement but segmented. And then, as our practice now gets even stronger and deeper, we might even see within one single segment, we might certainly discover even more details. And so it may occur, but please, this is not for everyone right now, and maybe later on, one might see within one rising movement all three characteristics of anicca, dukkha and anatta. Or in one, maybe one sees one segment and this segment is predominantly anicca, so it's impermanent. One sees the changing nature of it. When one goes deeper into this, then one might realize there's some dukkha aspect there, and one might also see there's an anatta aspect there. So, and one might see even more of the anicca aspect. So, according to very much in line with Mandelbrot's fractal theory, if we take one piece out of the rising movement or falling movement or a pain or whatever other object, and then go deeper into it, we might make some new discoveries. I'm just saying this for general knowledge, for you to explore when the time is ripe. Now, during this particular insight knowledge, as we've seen already, the mind easily falls on the predominant object without missing it. And as the Venerable Sadhu Pandita likes to point out, at this certain point, no particular aiming is necessary. The mind is already well skilled. The observing mind is already well skilled, so then just by directing it towards an object, it will be it will land right on that object, and so without going astray. And furthermore, during this phase in the in our meditation practice, the sitting posture tends to be how? Rather slouched and difficult to uphold or to maintain upright, or easy. straight. What do you think?
Easy to keep straight.
Oh, easy, yes, and easy to keep straight. Yes is correct. So the sitting posture will be upright, and it will be in most cases relaxed, and it will be easy to maintain this posture. So not much effort is required. And on top of this, so from a practical point of view, meditators also find themselves easily sitting for 2, sometimes even 3 hours non-stop. And what previously seemed like something impossible, now when one's practice has matured, becomes a very natural thing to do. And when it happens, not like this, and then one should make good use of this particular condition and just sit for longer stretches. Now, this then brings us to the end of tonight's Dhamma talk. And let me conclude. And those of you who have not yet reached this particular phase in the meditation practice, may you gain it quickly and experience it comprehensively, fully, and then may all of you continue with feel inspired and determined to continue with your meditation practice, and may the meditation of or the insight meditation lead you eventually to the realization of the peace of Nibbana through the attainment of stream entry, hopefully still during this retreat, otherwise during this very life. And so this is it. So let's hear your questions if you have any. Yes, who's that, John?
Yes. Why does our sense of sight seem so much more solid than the other senses?
The sense of sight? No. This is for the time being. It may just appear that way, but
well, that's what I'm asking. Why does it appear to be more solid than the other? I mean, I take it sight. If you were mindful enough, sight would appear like a movie film, the separate frames that we are seeing at a high speed.
And so
it seems like there's. That it's a solid thing that really isn't.
So, John, are you asking this question based on your own experience? Pardon me?
Yes, at another retreat.
Oh, during another retreat. Oh, good.
But so it just seems that when you see the rising and falling, it seems easier with some of the other senses than it does with the sense of sight. So there's something that makes us. So all I'm asking is
Necessarily agree with this, because when mindfulness is well developed and a meditator is clearly seeing the dissolution of the formations, then or of arising and falling other objects, then frequently a meditator will also say that looking at some tangible object or material object, it seems or it's seen as, just like you've described, a series of slides of still frames coming, going, and so it creates the impression of a continuity in the seeing, but in actuality it's not the case. And so it's not so uncommon for the meditators to see this and to report this.
So you think that the sight is just as easy to see the rise and the fall,
sure,
as any of the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. In, you know, as mentioned in one of the earlier Dhamma talks, I think on, you know, on wisdom, there's a short section on it. And so, you know, see, usually, you know, the way it happens is we develop our practice, you know, by using the, you know, primary object. So we see some new development first in the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. And so, you know, then gradually, you know, we start seeing other objects in the same light, and so including even, you know, during the walking meditation. Or sometimes it could be, you know, the latest development first is realized in the walking meditation, and then, you know, gradually it's, it also comes up in the sitting meditation. No. So if you were to, you know, just to, you know, more frequently, you know, pay attention to, you know, the seeing process itself, you know, then most likely you'll be, you know, seeing just what you've described in, or what you've experienced during an earlier retreat.
Okay, it just seems more difficult to me.
Try it a couple of times. Let's say after a good sitting. And then just maybe open your eyes and focus on some, you know, some object, and then see what happens.
Okay.
You know, you could take the Buddha statue up here, or, you know, whatever you like.
Okay.
And some meditators, you know, even go to the extent of reporting, you know, seeing some image, a mental image arising in the mind, and suddenly then, you know, seeing that image itself as coming, going, coming, going. I don't know. So then, what's next? Yes, Cindy.
Once the mind drops conceptualization, does it go back eventually once you leave the retreat?
Well, what do you think?
if you gain stream entry, does it go back?
All right. Yeah. So let's say, if you after a retreat like this, 20 days, so, you know, when you go back and you haven't gained the path, you know, then it's most likely, you know, and let's say at home you're not practicing that much, you know, then gradually over several weeks, you know, the world is certainly coming back together, things are becoming solid again. No. So then you'll have your solid world again. But if you were to gain the perception of the Dhamma, then you do a fair amount of daily practice, and your practice then is maybe in the fifth insight knowledge and higher, you'd be walking around with it, without a boundary. It's still functioning. No, you're welcome. So, Alan, you had a question.
Yes, you were talking about there are four levels of realization.
Yes.
The first one is, you know, the stream entrant, and then the once returner.
Yes.
Those two will be coming back.
Yes.
And the first one maybe no more than seven times.
Yes, right.
Okay, so at any given time, some of those people are on the planet somewhere.
Yeah, right.
So I have some questions about these people. First of all, do they know who they are? Would a master or an arhant know who they are? Are they likely to be monks and nuns, or are they teachers and plumbers? And then one last question is, you know, sometimes there are people who just become spontaneously realized. I mean, something like, I think Ramana Maharshi, you know, he was 18 years old, and he went into his uncle's study and just became realized. And he'd never practiced and didn't really care about religion before then. Is it likely that he and people like him are among that set of people who have returned?
Probably. Very much so. Well, so, any realization that has taken during a previous certain existence will have a tremendous influence on what happens during the present existence. And so, there are, for instance, these four ways or four modes of progress. Painful and slow progress, painful and quick progress, and then pleasant and slow progress, and pleasant and quick progress. And so people who've practiced before and even realized during a previous existence are likely regain the Dhamma in a very short period of time, a shorter period of time than an average person would. I guess it will be fair to assume that they'll be born, or that they'll find themselves in circumstances that that lead to or conducive to practice. And there is actually, and I'm remembering this just now, there is a Pali term for this, namely innate wisdom. No, a person is born with a rather highly developed level of wisdom, accompanied by a mind that is mostly governed by alobha, adosa, amoha, so non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. So the mind to start with is already rather pure, and I guess it will be fair to assume that such people will be naturally drawn to meditation at an early point and just do it and have no difficulty with it. I remember having heard of Western or Caucasian nun who just reflected on life, human existence, and she knew she wanted to be a nun and nothing else. And so she went in search of places for this. And she became a nun with Ajahn Sumedho at an early age in her life. Then there are others who just take longer time until they kind of see some suffering in life, at least enough to somewhat wake up. So there's that. And there is one category of stream angels. There are three different categories, and one is said to be born into good families. So a family that promotes an ethical or life of ethical conduct and a life of meditation and whatnot. Well, just I remember one case. Actually, it was from the Tibetan tradition. Minjur Rinpoche, who as a youngster, maybe 12, 13 years of age, demanded or asked that he be included for the first 3-year retreat. And so the retreat master at the time first refused, and then Minjur Rinpoche asked his relative, who was somewhere a higher placed up or a higher placed person, and so then with his help he managed to get into that first 3-year retreat, and apparently did so well in it that the retreat master said, okay, for the next retreat you'll be the retreat master. And he was still very young. And so there are, you know, there are some, you know, talented or gifted, you know, people around. Oh, and then, you know, I remember a young girl in Burma, and what was it? She's alive. She later on became a nun, and her introduction to meditation was as follows. Some friends or relatives of the family came, and then she, I guess she was at home or so, and it was like a farm-like setting, and then one of the relatives said, well, to the girl, why don't you meditate a little bit? If you meditate, I'll give you some candies. And then she said, okay, I'll meditate. And so she started sitting, and then while she was meditating, the other family members went in search of some cows which they couldn't find, and the meditating girl said, the cows are behind such and such a bush, and it was just as she had said. No, and so this was amazing to all involved, and so I guess that then triggered her an interest in meditation, and so that she soon became a nun and developed psychic abilities. And so I remember one person while I was living in Burma, one person went to see her together with some American visitor, a man, and the nun, I forgot her name, and so the nun didn't know the visitor at all, had no knowledge of him at all, and she would then look at him and contemplate a little bit, and tell him that he had such and such a surgery in this or that place, and it was perfectly correct. And she's got a big monastery in Burma, or a nunnery, and has many many younger nuns with her. So there are obviously people who naturally are gifted or talented. No. Okay. Then Nicola.
You mentioned about the joy. I can't remember the exact context, but something within Dharma practice being greater than the joy in the worldly lives of ordinary folks at some point tonight.
Eh?
And I was also wondering if the dukkha also surpasses that of ordinary folks up until a point where you get to liberation.
Oh. Well, the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness that comes up in one's meditation practice in the form of bodily pains and aches and very difficult mental states, and at times can be quite severe. Even stronger than for some ordinary person. Ordinary person who uses the usual ways of escaping from dukkha. So I would say that in the practice, at times the dukkha will be highlighted. But But on a positive note, we have all the means mental abilities to work with and overcome those forms of dukkha. Even if there's some amount of dukkha in the meditation practice, this should not keep us away from doing the practice, because in the end, overcoming the dukkha leads to tremendous freedom or liberation. So the gain is tremendous. Maybe, see, your question is somewhat difficult to answer, because for an ordinary non-meditator, all sorts of forms of dukkha are available or can come up. So if you think of a person who's suffering from some terminal illness or so, there's lots and lots of dukkha there. No? Now, what makes the difference is our ability to work with pain and to handle pain or difficult mental states. And it is in this connection that the equanimity counts a lot. So a meditator who's worked through pains and aches, worked through difficult mental states, and who has developed equanimity, will find it relatively easy to handle these. But a non-meditator may have tremendous difficulties. And to, as a case in point, we have a nun in a Burmese nun in Lumbini, Nasyanido Badamanika, and her mother was suffering from cancer. And her mother was an ardent meditator, or had been an ardent meditator over many years under Mahasisadu and Sadhu Pandita. And so she was well familiar with the practice, and also well familiar with dukkha. And when her cancer then developed into the final stages, she was hospitalized. And on one occasion, Sadhu Pandita visited her in the in the private hospital, and the doctors were praising her for saying that they had never seen a patient like this or like her, who had so patiently and calmly responded in the face of cancer. And apparently usually cancer patients they suffer tremendously. There's lots of probably groaning and crying and whatnot going on. And when Sanlindo Badamanika's mother passed away, she did so with with a serene look on her face. So the meditation practice is a tremendously useful tool when it comes to mastering the difficulties of an illness. Okay. If there are no more questions, yes, there's one in the back. Who's this?
Two.
Yes. So then, Yona.
It matured after the ten imperfections were sort of let go of.
Yeah. Well, it's not let go of. One develops a reasonable relationship to them.
But what? The equanimity, the imperfection of equanimity, that statement is hard for me to understand.
Eh?
Because it's also, equanimity is one of the enlightenment factors that you said is more present.
Yeah, right.
So I don't understand how equanimity fits into that.
Oh, see, no. some of these terms are synonymous. So equanimity comes up as an imperfection of insight, and as such it could also be termed as a budding as the budding enlightenment factor of equanimity. It's the same experience but different name.
So it's like being asked before that it's only an imperfection when they're conceived or
yes
or
right
etc.
Yes
oh, but, okay.
I know. And it's not that the equanimity drops away, it's just with the mature phase of the fourth insight knowledge, one is no longer under the sway of or influence of this craving, pride and conceit and wrong view.
So if equanimity is there, then you're relating it to it as a mental factor, and that there's maybe a weight in it.
Yeah, yeah, right, indeed. You just see it as a mental factor, and that's it. No, okay. So that's one question, and then the next one.
Yes, and I don't know if this is fair for me to.
Oh, Jackie.
When did you become interested or introduced to the practice, and how long have you been with it?
Oh my goodness! You really want to know? Oh well, let's keep it short and sweet. Namely, I could go on and on and on and on. Actually, it all started at home when I was a high school student, and part of the book on Hatha Yoga, there was a last chapter on meditation. It was Hatha Yoga meditation, and the recommendation in there was to set up a candle and light it, and then gaze at the flame. So this is what I did, just as an experiment. I didn't know anything about meditation at the time, and so I tried it out and found that it's really helping to calm the mind, and so I kept doing it for a while, and then to an extent that at one point, without telling anyone, I skipped school for 3 days and meditated all by myself in a separate apartment. We were living in a place where we had access to other rooms, and so I would stay in a separate apartment where no one else would enter. And so I'd show up for breakfast, I'd show up for lunch, but I wouldn't go to school. But then after a while my family found out and they didn't like it, and so anyways, I started during my high school days, but owing to being ridiculed by my family, they didn't understand it, and they just saw it as a waste of time and whatnot, and this is not what we do, and so then eventually I dropped it, and then followed what do you think, which path? The path of sin, of indulging in sense pleasures. And so I did this for a while, and then a number of years later, I ended up in Africa, and doing kind of an internship there with some company. It was part of my training, and then I remembered my meditation practice from the high school days, and I continued. So I picked it up again, and did a little bit of daily practice, and that was quite nice, and. It was nice to get back into that rhythm, and then let me see, and then a friend of mine, a fellow student, recommended that I go and attend a retreat with John Coleman in the Ubakin tradition. So that's Goenka's teacher was Ubakin. And so I did that in England. It was my first ever retreat. I'd never done a formal retreat before, and I liked it a lot. And then it went on and on. I came over here to the States and explored spirituality here for almost 2 years. Back then, see what happened. I wanted to go to India, and my mom just said, "No way, you're not going to India." she had heard all these terrible stories about Westerners ending up getting into difficulties in India, and so she was too afraid of it. And so I said, okay, well, if that's what you want, then I'll go to North America instead. We've got relatives here, and also there are plenty of spiritual communities in North America. And so then spend time traveling and hitchhiking all across the country, including Canada and Alaska, and spending time at one esoteric place, and then at the San Francisco Zen Center, and then at the City of 10,000 Buddhas in Talmadge, Ukiah, as a Chinese Buddhist place. And that was probably the most intensive meditation that I've ever experienced, even tougher than this Vipassana here. And at the monastery there, we went to bed. The last sitting ended at midnight, and then we had just barely had time to go to bed. I think wake up was at 2:30, and the first sitting started at 3. So you can imagine it was really tough. And so the monks and nuns there did it for, it was chan meditation, and so they did it for a month at a time, and I just wanted to do intensive practice, that was all. And so just intensive practice and longer retreats. Back then I was really groping in the dark, not knowing which way to go. And so eventually I returned to Europe, and so still not quite sure in how things would go on, but I did know it will be somewhere along the line of meditation, Buddhist meditation, and then community life, and things like this. And then, then together with a girlfriend who was into Tibetan Buddhism, I ended up in India. And then practicing prostrations, and at Bodhaya, and even doing the whole set of 100,000 prostrations. And then there was a retreat with Christopher Titmus, so I did that, and that was kind of a turning point. And so with that retreat, I knew I didn't want to do the Tibetan practice anymore, all the visualizations and all that. And instead, it was clear to the Vipassana, that's the right thing. and so on. And then I did one retreat after another, a 7-day retreat with Anagarika Munindra, and so then a 10-day retreat with Goenka outside of Jaipur in Rajasthan, and then another 10-day retreat with the assistant teacher of Goenka in Kathmandu, and outside of Kathmandu in Buddha Nilkanta, and so, and then a retreat with Sadhu Pandita. And back then I had no idea whatsoever who this Sadhu Pandita was. The only thing I knew was he's a famous meditation teacher, and he was going to conduct a 1-month retreat in Kathmandu, and I just wanted to do a longer retreat, that was all. And so I went, and it was quite something, that retreat. For various reasons. It was at the meditation center then. It was still under construction, and back then it was during July, or what was it? June, July. And it was the beginning of the rainy season. It rained like 3-4 days non-stop. We had water in the compound reaching up to the knees, and we had to walk, all of the meditators, we had to walk way through the water. And there were a number of foreign meditators attending the retreat, and then the septic tanks started overflowing, and so some of the foreigners saw that, and then it led to a huge exodus. Like, so about 95% of the foreigners left, and there were only 3 who remained, and I was one of them. And during that retreat, even Sadhu Pandita ended up with amoebic dysentery. Well, my first interviews with Sadhu Pandita were also something else. So maybe first, second interview was okay, but I vividly remember one interview. I had worked really hard in the meditation practice, and so just like all of you, trying really hard to observe the rising and falling carefully and to know all these many details and delicacies there, and so and then came the next interview, and so I reported, and Sadhu Pandita cut me off and said, "No, this cannot be what you're saying," and go back, that's it, finished. And I thought, my goodness, pretty tough treatment. And I just reported to him what I had experienced, but apparently he misinterpreted it, or saw it differently, or it was my language, who knows. And so, but anyways, I still continued until the very end. And so at the end, or towards the end of the retreat, there was venerable Nepalese monk Sadhu Nyanaponika, who had studied in Burma for many years with Sadhu Pandita, but also Pariyatti studies. So he was translating, and he was the translator for Sadhu Pandita, and he then showed some slides of Burma, of the Mahasi Center, main center in Yangon, Burma. And while he was doing this, he said, for anyone who wants to do a longer retreat, this is probably the best center in the world. I just heard that sentence, I knew I was going to go to Burma. And at that time, I did not know where Burma was, and so didn't know how to get a visa, and all of these things. And so then I went back to Europe and applied for a Burmese visa, eventually got one, and then entered the country, and it happened to be April 1988. And April 1988 was the beginning of the riots in Burma. And there were riots in Burma for several months. And so those were really heavy riots, more or less across the entire country, and with hundreds of thousands of people involved in demonstrating. And so back then, we were a group of foreign meditators staying at the Masi Center, and every once in a while, during the daytime, at night time, there were gunshots. And on one occasion, I remember a group of men walking down the road, some nearby road, and then even chanting anti-government slogans. And later on, there were some shots, and that was it. So it was really quite a time of great upheaval in Burma. And then when I entered the country, I entered as a lay person, and I had no intention whatsoever to become a monastic. But then, because of the political situation, the government wanted all the foreigners to leave the country, and so they then issued a rule saying with the expiry of one's stay visa or stay permit, all the foreigners should leave. And so my turn was up in November of that year, and I simply didn't want to go. I just wanted to continue with the intensive practice. And so then upon asking around, the then director general of the Department of Religious Affairs, he recommended, well, why don't you become a temporary monk? And so, as such, the rule doesn't apply to those, and as such, you can stay. And so then I proposed or mentioned this to Sadhu Pandita, and he said just the same thing. And so then, owing to political reasons, I became a monk. Then I was enrolled, and before ordaining, I made it very clear that this was only a temporary ordination. Since my mother had requested I had given her a promise to return. To Europe whenever she needs some help with her business. And so knowing this promise, so I made it very clear that it was only a temporary ordination. And so then after about 3 months, my mother took me up on this, and so then I disrupted and went back to Europe to help her with her business at the time. And however, that experience of being in ropes for 3 months overall was positive, and not easy, but positive. And while I was back in Austria, my mom was working there at the time. I decided that I was going to go back to Burma for a second time and for another longer retreat, and this time taking the ropes. And so the following year, or in 1989, I re-entered the country in Burma in September, and in November took ordination, and I've been in ropes ever since. So that's 17, 18 years by now. And so most of the monastic training was under Sadhu Pandita. In terms of meditation teachers, I've had different ones, but the main teacher has always been Sadhu Pandita. And then No, well, and then after a period of altogether 9 years in Burma, then one day Sadhu Pandita asked me whether I would like to come along to Nepal and serve as his interpreter. And so I said, yeah, well, okay, why not? And so I went, and at the time, well, this Pandita Rama Lumbini International Vipassana Meditation Center was under construction. And so and I liked the place a lot, and saw it, and since it was still under construction, I saw it as an opportunity to finally get some practice in myself, because during the 2 preceding years at the Semaingon Forest Meditation Center in Burma, together with others, we were involved in planning and implementing a new forest meditation center. It was just 2 years, so there was work non-stop, and with less and less and less time for practice. And so then I asked Sadhu Pandita for permission to stay for another couple of months, and he said, yes, okay, you can. And then as that period came to an end, then I asked for another extension. Again, he gave the permission, and then another extension. And so in this way, a whole year went by. And so by the time he came back to Lumbini the following year, and that was 99, I suppose. Yeah, 99. By that certain time, the place was already, operating to some extent, and he was satisfied, and he said, "Okay, you can stay for 5 years." And so by now, it's been already 9 years, over 9 years, and that's it.
Would you tell us at another time, maybe more about where you lived and what the monastery?
Say what?
Maybe when another day, would you tell us more about the monastery there?
Well, a little bit. I don't want to talk too much, otherwise we will get flooded with meditators. But this much I can say: it's a nice place for intensive long-term practice. And
how many meditators are there just now?
How many do we have right now? Sally Dobadamanika, the Burmese nun whom I mentioned earlier on, she sent an email the other day saying, and up to that point there were 8, and then 6 left, so 2 are left, and suddenness, another one was expected to come. But the numbers go up and down. So in the winter, usually our largest number of meditators we have in the winter, so from about, let's say, beginning October until end of March, so fall, winter, spring, and during that period maybe on the average about 18 to 20, sometimes a little bit more, 21, 20, it's family style. And okay, maybe this much for tonight.